Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's June 17th. I'm honored to know and to recognize already that Nader Stay is the New York State Assembly member representing District 90, which is totally comprised of Yonkers, is already on the line. Good morning, Assembly member. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Hezzy. Always a pleasure to be on the show. Friday, June 17th. We're moving along. Soon we'll be in the midst of summer, and you know, we just finished the Albany part of the assembly role, which is session, and very glad. It's been a very productive session for us, and now we will continue to focus on the Yonkers portion of the district, you know, where we have an office in Yonkers, one in Albany. And this is where the highest percentage of constituent services takes place, has you right here in the Yonkers office. So nice to be on the show.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit confused before we get to all those things that you do at your office in Albany and in Yonkers, of course. You know, elections are coming around the corner, and I think it's so confusing. Most people don't even know if the elections are coming, but the elections are coming very shortly, and I think a lot of people are confused. But what's exciting about you is you've also, for the first time, you've also chosen to take another a party line that are willing to endorse you as a candidate. That's fantastic. That's huge.
I appreciate it. Yes, my reelection again is this November. And as you know, I was elected in 2018, was reelected in 2020. So every 2 years, there's an election for the Assembly and the Senate members. It's a 2-year term, and sometimes you feel you're always running for office, but you got to really gauge your time. You got to make sure that you stay visible, you stay active, and anybody that has followed my agenda, they know that historically, I mean, for many, many years before my role as an assemblyman, I served as a school principal in Yonkers for the public schools for over 30 years and served 6 years on the Board of Education, 3 years as president of the Board of Education. So for me, long before my role as an assemblyman, I've been fortunate And I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to serve for many years in Yonkers on so many, so many boards and commissions, hospital boards. I served as chairman of the Parking Authority on the board, the Parks Board in Yonkers, served on hospital boards. So I feel a sense of gratitude for that experience that today I really believe helps me a lot as an assemblyman. So when we talk about education, I know education as well as anyone in the state. When we talk about healthcare, I know about healthcare. I know about what impacts hospitals, especially we have two hospitals in Yonkers, St. John's Riverside and St. Joe's. You know, I have an opportunity to meet often with the CEOs of the hospital, with trustees that are involved, with doctors and nurses and healthcare providers. So it's a good opportunity when you have the experience. It's hands-on. You understand how it works. And this way, you can either legislate or you can encourage and advocate for various budgetary concerns and needs. And that's what I think, you know, helps me become as effective as I am. And that is, you know, my ability to understand, to advocate, and to really, you know, have that hands-on experience that really helps us. But to your point, there is a re-election this November. I have an opponent, and my opponent has the Republican and conservative nominations. And as you know, I am a Democrat, and but I was a little concerned that over the last couple of years, there's been a need to really reinforce you know, a secondary party for many Democrats in New York State. Many Democrats have the working family endorsement, and which I don't have. I feel that my political stand as a moderate Democrat is such where my philosophy wasn't always on target with the working family. So what I did, I went out and to get a new political party online for November, you have to get 1,500 signatures or a petition with 1,500 for Yonkers for the assembly seat to develop a new political party. So I went out and we got a lot more signatures and we qualified for a new party that I will have in November called Fair Play. And that's amazing because in many ways, Fair Play to me is very similar to the New Deal. You know, many of us here in America recall the days of Franklin Roosevelt and he had the New Deal. The New Deal was an enormous effort by the federal government during that time to really encourage job development and promote opportunities. And it was a time when we needed to really get America working. And through the New Deal legislation, you know, we put a tremendous amount of funding and effort nationally on building schools and building dams and building and repairing our streets and the infrastructure. And that philosophy for me, you know, was something we needed today. And when, as a Democrat, I said, well, if I need a second party, because as we know, we have a lot of Republican friends and non-Democrats, you know, either non-party registrations or people that were formerly independents or reform or green or women's equality. I mean, we had like 8 political parties a number of years ago, but with the new changes in the law, many of these smaller political minor parties really went out of existence because in the governor's race, you got to get, you know, at that time it was 50,000 votes. Now it's 250,000. So many of these small parties went out of existence. So this was an opportunity for me to get that second line, and that second line allowed me two parties or two lines for November. And for me, I value that Fair Play Party and what it stands for, you know, and it's something that largely I set the tone as an assemblyman for, you know, what I would do in with that Fair Play Party. And I look at it as a line that purely and strongly supports, you know, middle class tax cuts, that looks at bail reform and looks at ways to reform bail reform when necessary. And as you know, there's been a lot of concern about crime. And of course, crime for me is extremely important. You know, I support as an educator for years any initiative that keeps us safe, keeps our children safe. And God knows with all the shootings that have taken place all across the country and here in New York, we had shootings in Buffalo not too long ago. You know, we initiated a lot of good legislation that really attempts to get guns off the street, that promotes safety. And it's not only in schools, Hezzy. We, you know, we've noticed, you know, people are shot at in churches, religious organizations, in supermarkets, and wherever there's hate or there's a gathering, you know, you see this take place. And as a country, we prize ourselves with being one of the most civilized countries in the world. But then you look at what happens here in America, and you see the level of crime and the level of division and polarization and hate. And it really is sad. It's sad that this is taking place here in America, and people all over the world are saying, what's going on there? I mean, we grew up, many of us, you and I, in a time when politics was such where, you know, the winners, you know, once they won, they took office, they became representatives of everyone. I mean, that's the whole, that's the whole process of democracy. You know, you seek office, you have a platform, and once you win, you know, and you're supported by the majority of voters and citizens, then at that point, you know, you're the representative of the entire nation or the entire state, or in my case, the 90th Assembly District that represents Yonkers. And but today, the polarization that has gotten to the level of division and hate is such that, you know, you have so many crazy individuals out there that are extremists that cause so many issues and concerns in society. But we got to get back and say, what do we do to fix that? And, you know, my style is not just to acknowledge we have a need, but my style has always been, what do we do to fix it? You know, I did that as an educator. I did that as president of the Board of Education. How do we address the needs of all children, whether English language learners or special ed students? And that's what a legislator at any level needs to know. They need to be aware of their community, of their constituents, and they need to be proactive. You can't just hold office and sit back like many public officials out there. They get elected and, you know, they only run out and see the community when it's re-election time. You know, your job as an elected official is to be visible and active and proactive throughout your term, no matter what seat you hold. So for me, the Fair Play Party is really an opportunity for me to expand my base, to make sure that individuals recognize that as a Democrat, you know, there's many moderate or there's many mainstream Democrats. That's the party that Franklin Roosevelt and, you know, and John Kennedy and others have preached for years, a party that represents, you know, immigrants and the labor movement and people that, you know, focus on, you know, the American dream. And anybody that knows my background, I'm an immigrant. I came here at the age of 4 years old and, you know, worked hard and wasn't easy. And, you know, even as a teenager had to work, you know, in many jobs that today many people don't want to do, washing pots and dishes and working in restaurants. And, you know, and that's what it took. It took that hard work to recognize that, hey, yes, this is a land of opportunity, but, you know, don't take things for granted. You got to work hard, and you got to get a good education, and that's what we did. You know, thankfully, all my siblings were well-educated and had reputable careers, and I attribute that to this feeling that I grew up with, you know, that promotes the rights of working people and immigrants and labor and making sure. That's why I'm a big advocate of labor-related issues and union concerns and make sure that there's good paying jobs, because it's not easy to live and raise a family here in Yonkers and Westchester and New York State. People have left the state to get to states where it's cheaper. So I'm advocating for good paying jobs so that families can stay to live here, to pay their mortgages and to pay their rent and pay their children's education and really be able to afford living in our community here. And that's part of the Fair Play.
Absolutely. But based on all of that, when did we move away from the old standards, the old concepts that informed the nation, whether you were an immigrant or whether you were born here or no matter your ethnic background and so on and so forth? Are we just in a tumult of some sort and we're trying to find our way? So, you know, your concept of bringing back some old standards of respect and education and just recognition of people is very, very compelling. And did you find it when you advise people that you've created this new political platform that you're going to be, you know, seeking votes on? Do they recognize the value of it? Do they recognize the new concept, the mental concept of what you're promoting?
Well, you know, politically
speaking, this is like old stuff in a way.
Well, and it is, and people do recognize. When I speak to many and I explain to them you know, my platform for this fair play. They open up their ears and they say, you know, you're right. We did lose a lot, you know, of the old time traditional value system or the standards for, you know, what we as families growing up in New York, especially immigrant families, need to do to get ahead. And, you know, and I look at the example over the last couple of years, you know, we went through a tremendous difficult time with the pandemic, with COVID-19, and with many of us lost a lot of loved ones, and it was difficult. And as a society, you know, America, we've always been blessed, you know, with the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, and immigrants coming here and working hard, and we've always had a system, Hezzy, with whether it was DSS or Catholic Charities or Section 8 or other support mechanisms. We've had a system that, you know, allowed people the help they need, you know, when they're going through difficult times. So, you know, all of us have been advocates of that system, and, you know, we preached a continuation of those opportunities to help people in need. That's where we are. We're a system, we're a society that understands there's issues of haves and haves not. It isn't a land of opportunity, but sometimes individuals, whether they have other factors that impact them, you know, don't have that same opportunity. So yes, let's provide more education, more training, more mental illness, more keeping people out of jail and getting people into productive lives. I'm a big advocate of that, you know, especially putting on my educator hat on. But at the same time, we learned the last couple of years that there's a lot of abuse in our system. And when during the COVID-19 with federal and state stimulus and programs, too many individuals that, in my opinion, didn't deserve, you know, to get these stimulus checks or small business applications or unemployment claims. There was a lot of abuse. And I was one of the people that stood up and said, you know, we have a system in place, reinforce it, and make sure that individuals that are applying for these benefits, you know, qualify for these benefits. If somebody had COVID-19 and they were sick, or somebody was truly unemployed and so forth, yes, let's put together these protective methods and devices to allow this person to get off, you know, to get on their feet again and restore their livelihood and so forth. But now we find out, you know, anywhere from a quarter to a third of funds distributed were probably abusive or fraudulent. And as a society, to me, that's a fault. That's why today, you know, you read the papers, and you don't have to read the papers. Look at what's going on with inflation. The last couple of months, you know, it's gotten so bad that, you know, the government has to put the brakes on this rise in inflation, where, you know, we go to the supermarket, you know, and you look at what, you know, what you could buy, you know, a year ago or more, you know, with $100, you know, in grocery. And today, you know, you're getting half the products. You know, you go to put gas in your car, and gas is so costly. You know, we never imagined a couple of years ago that gas would be over $5 a gallon. I mean, you know, that's really traumatic. A lot of people can't even, you know, drive these days. They can't afford. You know, years ago, you put $30 worth of gas, you got a full tank of gas. Now you're lucky if you get a half a tank of gas for what you're paying. And so, you know, yes, New York State, we are proactive. We did the benefit with the reducing or getting rid of the New York State sales tax on gas. Westchester County followed suit. So allegedly, you know, we believe with the state and the county savings on gas tax, you know, we removed some 40 to 50 cents a gallon, you know. But then the problem is, you know, as a legislator, you know, I'm just thinking ahead and saying, Well, is government, when we reduce or take away the 40, 50 cents of taxes, right, are we making sure the middle oil producers and the stations and the people that are the middlemen or middle business people, are they raising their prices to take advantage of whatever efforts we do?
That was the problem. Isn't that
well,
the problem?
Well, that's the problem.
So why do we permit all these lax ways to get around and about the legislation? It's not that the people who are legislators are stupid, and they even have staff that can tell them, hey, this is not going to work. Why do we have so many loopholes?
Because of a lack of planning.
Is it lack of planning? I didn't realize.
It's a lack of
planning.
I mean, you know what?
But who's not planning?
You know, whether, you know, the executive branch of every government, I'm planning, but I'm looking, you know, as soon as this tax initiative, this tax saving on gas went into place, my initial thought early on was, what are we doing to make sure that, you know, we're monitoring to make sure that people don't play with this and people, you know, don't take advantage where at the end of the day, oh, well, there's 40, 50 cents less in taxes, so I'm going to raise my price by, 30 cents more. This way, you know, at the end of the day, it's really a 10 cent saving, right? And that's not fair. If it was intended to be a 46 cents, for example, reduction, then that should be reflective at the end of the day. It shouldn't be. So
don't the people recognize that if you authorize through government a 40 cent discount and the middle people who are in corporate America say, you know what, we're going to raise our prices by 30 cents. So what we're doing is we're really subsidizing big business for 30 cents a gallon. Rather than supporting the poor consumer who's not earning any money, but is saving a couple of bucks that they could barely afford. Is that the problem with our government, that the equity is no longer there? And why don't we recognize it? I mean, you do. That's why I'm so honored to speak to you, because you explain it.
Well, it's crucial. I mean, for example, you know, that gas tax exemption took place. They call it the holiday, you know, to reflect a real time of need, you know, from June 1st. June 1st in New York State, and especially here in Westchester County, we should be seeing, in my opinion, when you couple state taxes and county taxes here in Westchester, you should be seeing a 46 cents saving on per gallon of gas. And honestly, when they talk about the regional and the national averages of gas, and we're up there, we're here in Yonkers, you know, and I've been around and I monitor prices, you know, the lowest you find is between $4 for regular gas, $4.88, possibly up to $5.10 is the going rate.
Well,
but that's what it was in May. So I'm looking at it and saying, you know, what happened between May, where this was to a large extent the average, and today?
Yeah.
You know, we're supposed to be in the midst where they're not charging state or county taxes. Why are we still paying what I see out there, the same average? So as even though the intent was, let's save the consumers this amount of money, is it really a saving? Did the middleman or the corporation heads raise their prices where we're at the same level? You know, I'm not sure.
Well,
but,
that's the thing where the disconnect is, that if government is willing to absorb, let's say, a 40 or 50 cent per gallon saving that they're not going to tax the consumer, then why should the business just take that extra 30 or 40 cents and tack it on to their profit level? Why are they getting a bonus? Because
I've been
there's a problem here.
You're right. Well, I've been speaking to a lot of representatives and trying to get this message across, saying to the people in charge, you know, they should immediately, if I was passing a legislation like this, I would immediately have gotten on board some of the top brains or individuals involved with these type of businesses, you know, for example, with gas prices, and said, okay, guys, tell me what the process is. Tell me who the decision makers are with this business or this element, and what can we do to monitor it and make sure that, hey, in May, if this is your prices in May, unless you can show me that you're paying more for the product, we're going to monitor you and make sure that this 46 cent saving is applicable to the consumers. Because if you don't, and you're, you know, you're doing what we call as price gouging, where, hey, there's a demand, so I'm going to take advantage and make believe, you know, and charge a lot more because something is in demand, even if it's very hurtful for the consumer. Similar to what's happening, you know, with baby infant formula. You know, in my opinion, I think business people in the middle took advantage of that. Well, the shipment wasn't done in a timely fashion, or this company wasn't producing and they're going to get that process going, or this is coming from Germany or coming from Turkey or elsewhere. You know, we heard all these stories, and, you know, who's monitoring that? We're always behind the eight ball.
The thing that's interesting is the corporate structure, the place where the baby infant formula was infected by something or another in the factory here in the United States. When they realized they were infected, they didn't clean it, awaiting material to come in, you know, the raw material that's necessary for creating the formula. They just waited for the formula to start being produced abroad. I think a lot came from China, but it doesn't matter where it came from. It's not their fault. The point is there was a shortage. They eventually built it up, and yet we had to wait another 2 weeks because the company here in America didn't do anything. Why did we have to wait for them to clean up? It would have cost them exactly the same to clean it up 3 months ago as it is to clean it up now, except now we have another 2 weeks wait for the factory to working. And then even when you look at the cost of oil, for example, it's a spot market. It's not like this is rocket science. I can tell you every day the cost of production of oil. I can tell you the difference between Western Texas Intermediate oil and the oil that's on the spot market on the international stage. What's wrong with people that they don't get it?
Well,
it's not like this is rocket science. I'm not the most brilliant guy in the room, let me tell you.
But you're so right. I mean, you know, we're two reactionaries. You know, we react to issues and concerns and crisis. And, you know, we got to develop a government. We got to develop strategies that are proactive, that are preventive, you know, that have the vision.
You're 100% right. But does it fall on people like Nader Sayers, who's the assembly member, who represents the 90th district, and because your demeanor is such that you're concerned and you recognize the disproportionality of this struggle that is caused, that has nothing to do with the consumer. Consumer didn't create this problem. It's supply and demand. It's people gouging, all kinds of other issues. So does it just take an individual? So a Nader Sayers, you are the good guy, and then a lot of other people who may be in political office, they're not the good guys. So
well,
is there a way
people,
to ameliorate that?
Well, people sometimes, you know, mean well, but, you know, to be fair to my colleagues, I guess, on every level, you know, to be fair. But at the end of the day, you got to be a visionary. You got to be able, like I said, you know, to use your experience and your knowledge to say, hey, you know, what's happening here? What can I do to help this issue? You know, we spoke about the gas exemption that, you know, the intent is a really necessary, meaningful intent. And then, you know, during this past session, I realized talking to so many mothers and individuals that had something, you know, a big problem, a big concern with diapers. And diapers,
yeah,
to me, is not a luxury. It's a major necessity, you know, and I ran into so many mothers that were nearly crying, some of them, you know, in areas of Yonkers and Westchester and throughout the state where, you know, mothers that really couldn't afford diapers. I mean, something
mm-hmm.
that's a necessity. And, you know, and you look at the prices where to buy a box of diapers, you're talking about $30-$40. I mean, it's, and sometimes,
yeah,
you know, mothers leave their kids or forced to leave their babies in diapers that are wet or diapers,
mm-hmm.
and the children develop bad rashes and skin concerns.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not a happy thing where even if your child is in a wet diaper and you know, and you're embarrassed because you ran out of diapers and the child has to stay either in their room or crib, or, you know, you can't give
mm-hmm.
the baby to siblings or to, you know, family members or grandparents in some cases because, hey, the kid is not clean or doesn't have a dry diaper on. It becomes
right.
a social issue. It's an embarrassment. So something like that, for example, led me to say, well, what can I do to help these parents out? And I established this session, a legislative
mm-hmm.
piece that reduces the taxes on diapers, not only infant diapers, but adult diapers. And people said, you know, this is really common sense. And this is,
yes, it is.
This was legislation that, you know,
it's compassionate.
People are, yes, compassionate. And you know, sure enough, legislators on both sides of the aisle, you know, Democrats as well as Republicans all across the state, said, hey, you know, this makes a lot of sense, Sage. We want to join on that. I had, like,
mm-hmm.
in the Assembly, my legislation, Assembly Bill 8528, it's called the Diaper Act Bill, Diaper Tax Saving Bill, and it's a Sage
mm-hmm.
bill. You know, I sponsored it in the Assembly, and I spoke to
right.
Senator Jamal Bailey from across in the Bronx, who was the sponsor
mm-hmm.
in the Senate. And the bill was passed unanimously, 63-0 in the Senate, and it passed 146-0 in the Assembly. And that's the type of legislation that is necessary, it's needed. And recently,
but
by the way,
what, you know what that tells me? What it tells me, you're right, it's necessary and needed. But what's so interesting about the numbers of people who are in elected office who recognized the validity of the legislation that you brought forward is that they didn't recognize this concept, which was indicative of a social issue. And it took someone like you because of your experience in life. And that really matters a great deal. You know, you weren't born with a silver spoon in your mouth. It was rough. And you had to study, and you had only your mother to watch over the entire family. So I mean,
that's
when
true.
You think about all of this stuff, people don't recognize how the ingredients that it takes to build a man like Nader says. It is absolutely mind-boggling. But it is so stellar. And yet why is it that we don't even recognize that when we go for political advocates that we want to elect into office, why is it that we don't recognize the value of the people we want to elect? And sometimes we overlook them when they have the capacity to do what we need. Because there's no other way. Then we can't convince you.
That's why, to your credit and others that really work hard to disseminate information, to interview public officials, to speak about the issues and concerns confronting our city here in Yonkers and Westchester, New York, and the nation. And you and I often even bring in international topics because,
yes,
you know, we got to begin to look us at ourselves as global citizens of the world, which, you know, leads mm-hmm. us to more of an effort to be more people-oriented, to respect people for who they are, to respect differences, which means, you know, racial and ethnic and traditional. And
yeah.
And that's what we as legislators need to do. You know, the diaper thing, you know, and I spoke at a diaper bank celebration we had, really a press conference mm-hmm. recently, and really thanked all the volunteers. And I realized by sponsoring this diaper legislation, I started yeah. to reach out local and Westchester, New York State organizations, national diaper banks. And it's amazing, here's how many volunteers that give of their time and donate diapers and give them to people of need. And so it was also an opportunity to thank these individuals. When we were lobbying for this bill in Albany this session last month, so many of them
right.
came up to Albany. You know, we thanked them, we honored them with certificates, and really said thank you, because they were, you know, there for years pushing the cause of making sure that individuals that needed diapers were given the diapers. And, you know, and I recall as a grandparent, right, you know, mm-hmm. I have four grandchildren now and one on the way. And, you know, when you start seeing grandparents and others buying diapers as gifts for baptisms and
yeah.
for children's birthdays and stuff mm-hmm. like that, and showers, right, you begin to realize, you know, that it's such a necessity and it's so costly. Imagine that something that's a necessity and people are giving individuals diapers as gifts because they know how necessary it is and how costly it is. You know, it's just an example of the need. And by the way, Hezzy, when people talk about diapers, you know, the tendency is to think of diapers only for infants, but also many senior citizens, many disabled individuals, people that
yes.
rely on diapers, adult diapers. This also includes, this legislation, adult diapers. How many senior citizens that also can't afford, you know, diapers, because adult diapers, because they're too expensive for people that are
mm-hmm.
disabled and have concerns where you have urine leakage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I remember for years when sometimes we used to visit either at senior citizen centers or even just seniors in their homes, and there
yeah.
was always scent, a smell, and people used
mm-hmm.
to refer it as the old person smell, you know, the old
mm-hmm.
man's smell. And you say to yourself, what is this old man's smell?
Right.
And it was very embarrassing. It was as a result of urine leakage that sometimes
mm-hmm.
people can't help it and they can't afford the diapers. So what happens, you know, they start isolating themselves. They stop visiting because sometimes they have accidents and, you know, it's embarrassing and the smell. And
right.
and very often it causes health-related, emotional, you know, it causes social disenchantment or
mm-hmm.
disabilities. And you know, I myself, you know, have witnessed this tremendously. So, you know, for me, this diaper legislation, I believe, was a win-win. And people don't realize that the taxes that the state, you know, taxes, that was through legislation stopped in 2006. Imagine there was legislation
mm-hmm.
by New York State in 2006 that said, you know, we want to make sure that the state doesn't tax diapers. Great, right? Then you find
yes.
out municipalities and counties and cities throughout the state were taxing diapers. So in a way,
mm-hmm.
this is taking things back and saying, wait, when the state passed this legislation back in 2006, shouldn't they have been more clear to say, hey, if we as a state are getting rid of taxes on diapers, it should be a statewide policy. so that you can't, as a city or a municipality or a county, say, well, I want to tax diapers. You know, so we fixed that. And for me in Yonkers, you know, I looked at the tax rate here in Yonkers and Westchester. You know that Yonkers has a 4.78, nearly 5% tax on diapers, and Westchester County has a 4.38%. You know, again,
really?
In Yonkers, you're talking about 5% taxes on diapers that now with this legislation that was passed by the Assembly and the Senate, hopefully very shortly, the word is the governor would sign it into law,
mm-hmm.
and then it would become the law of the land here in New York State. And I'm looking forward to that. I expect this any day now. And as I said earlier, Hezzy, that's a win-win. It was one of those initiatives where, you know, you react to a concern and you say, well, what can we do to help? And this is one of those examples.
Well, that's a question in my mind, too, because as you're explaining all of this, does let's say, like a city like Yonkers, does it need to impose a 4.5% tax on diapers? Does the county need to impose another 5% on taxes? Is there no formula that permits a product to be sold without it being taxed? Or is there a way of coming to a baseline where every product that you buy has a baseline of taxes? And why should there be a different tax structure for a diaper as opposed to a baby formula or as opposed to buying a car?
Well,
is there no balance that way, or is that just too beyond the capacity of even contemplating? That's a huge thing.
Everything
is taxed differently.
You're right. Years ago, municipalities and counties and even state government, you know, they tax based on, you know, needs. You know, the more social programs, the more initiatives you
mm-hmm.
have in place, the more to fund education and healthcare and other areas.
Yeah.
You know, the main source of revenue for the state is taxation. And many municipalities follow that pattern, and they say, well, when we're short of funds, what can we do? What can we tax, you know, to bring in more revenue? But the last decade that I've witnessed in New York State, you know, we've changed the tax laws. You know, there's been more taxation for major corporations and multimillionaires
mm-hmm.
and others, so that, in my opinion, there's more revenue generated. So with more revenue
uh-huh.
generated on the state level, municipalities are getting more funding. You know, for example, the level of funding for education. In the case of Yonkers, you know, whatever you can't get from the state or the federal level, then the individual taxpayers or the Yonkers citizens have to pay for it. Now, anytime, for example, when we increase the amount of funding as we have for education in Yonkers, then that really reduces the burden on local government. When we give the municipalities, like we did this year, City of Yonkers, you know, a lot more money for what they call the AIM program, aid to municipalities,
mm-hmm.
you know, that
right.
allows the city to use that, you know, for DPW projects and, you know, funding to deal with water flooding issues and other concerns and maintaining streets and so forth. So it's a cycle. It's a cycle of, you know, what government at the local, county, state needs
to function. You know what's so interesting, though? There is no oversight. For example, I remember years ago, we had hired a company in, I think they were from Pennsylvania, but don't rest it on that. But they were supposedly very, very good with regard to water. So it was a system that would advise us of how much water we were using. And it would be like a measurement. And so if you were using water in your home, you would be charged based on your usage. Same thing with big companies that needed water or whatever. But then it turned out, for example, all of a sudden we saw an increase in the cost of water. And nobody seemed to look into it. It turns out that there was leakage in the system that was installed that was supposed to be the best there was. I don't even think that we got reimbursed from the company that said this was going to be a perfect system and it wouldn't break down, but it did.
It did break down.
So we never really came to the point where we realized, hey, they owe us money because they were charging us and we didn't even know the water was leaking into the ground.
Yeah. Water has become, the last 10 years, even in Yonkers, I remember,
yes.
You know, the average household was paying, you know, if it was every 6 months, for example, was paying mm-hmm. maybe $300 for water, a water bill.
Right.
You know, now they're getting bills, you know, $1,000 every 6 months. I mean, when you see the rates double and triple the last 10 years, and in many cases, water bill becomes almost like another mortgage. It just adds on to the frustration of homeowners, you know. And, you know, many of us in government, you know, look at simple things that people say, well, it's only the water bill. But, you know, when you couple the water bill
it's
with
everything.
The mortgage bill and the utility costs and look at the rates Con Ed has been charging the last decade,
mm-hmm.
you know, rates have tripled, you know, in many instances, you know, it's tough. So that's why, you know, something as simple, supporting major legislation where middle, you know, every property owner basically is going to get about $1,000 back soon, you know, from the state as tax rebates.
Wow.
Right. So these type of rebates for middle class, for property owners, you know, tax exemptions on diapers, on gas, you know, these are all part of initiatives to say, hey, what can we do to help people out now more than ever? This is tough times. And, you know, I prize myself with, you know, being an advocate, a real advocate for the consumer, for people that need, you know, for students, for property owners, even for people seeking decent paying jobs. You know, with this new MGM, you know, project, you know, we're very happy that, you know, we worked very closely with this new MGM acquisition of Empire Casino and Yonkers Raceway.
Yes.
And now we're in the process, you know, with the 3 licensing for sport betting and table gambling that the state has given out. It's most likely that MGM and Yonkers would get one of those 3 licenses. And that's going to generate a lot more, you know, revenue and taxation for Yonkers and New York State. And it's also, you know, going to generate what I believe to be 1,200 really good paying jobs. So, you know, that's part of revitalizing the economy. And that's part of what we spoke about earlier, making sure that not only do you give somebody a job, but you give them a job where they can really earn a living. Even with home care workers, you know, we increase that where not only can family members take care of seniors or people that are familiar, but they will pay them and pay them a decent job and make it where people can make it a profession, but feel good about that it's not something paying them like working, flipping burgers or whatever, no disrespect for anyone, but, you know, good paying jobs with benefits where, you know, we can require certain training and certification. And that's what, you know, that's what having the foresight and being proactive as a legislator involved, looking at legislation in Albany that really addresses those short-term and long-term needs. And, you know, we say to the listening audience all the time, the New York State Assembly is where policy starts. So now that session is over in Albany, this is a time when legislators are back in their districts, right, to reach out. Mm-hmm. If somebody, for example, thinks there's a better way to change rules or policies or procedures in New York State involved in anything, you know, reach out and reach out to your legislator and say, you know what, this policy is unfair. or this policy can work better if we change a few things in the requirements or the procedure itself.
Well, you know, that's a brilliant concept, because in a sense you're challenging the consumer, which in this case is a citizen or the resident. You'll have to be a citizen, but you reside here. And so is the public really involved as much as they should in order to be able to stop, excuse the term, bitching about this, that, or the other, when a lot of people are just not familiar with those concerns? And because we're all different and we all grew up differently, we have different backgrounds. We have a different understanding.
I've been echoing this important topic on your show and elsewhere for a while, and it's really convincing people that, you know, good things happen from speaking up. You know, as my role as a school principal for 30 years, some of the best initiatives to make change at the school level or district came from students that reached out, or parents or teachers, and said, hey, Dr. Sayage, you know, we can do this a better way, or there's a better way. Oh, really? Tell me about it. Tell me what do you recommend? And we initiated a lot of great initiatives that not only for, you know, I was principal of school 13 for many years, and was principal at school 9 and school 22. And, you know, during those times, you know, a lot of great, what I call best practices, we initiated district-wide when I was on the Board of Trustees or President of the Board of Education. So anything that works well shouldn't be limited to one spot. You know, for example, not too long ago, we passed the gift card tax. If you recall, we spoke about it.
I remember that very well.
Yeah, and that's when people said to us, well, you know, Nader, you know, I was looking through my drawer and I saw an expired gift card. Wow, I lost that on it. It was either $100 or $250, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And we looked at it and said, you know, why should they expire? So I sponsored legislation that passed and signed by the governor that will, you know, make sure gift cards are not expired. And people said, wow,
that
was
brilliant. That was one of the first pieces of legislation that you were able to pass.
Correct.
I was like, I was taken aback by how smart it was, and it was never recognized for so long until you came along.
It was so simple, but it was based on, and then I had, even before the pandemic, and this was such a timely piece of legislation, before the pandemic, people that I spoke to that were involved, you know, as EMT, you know, emergency drivers and staff members, or, you know, ambulances and EMT, they said, you know what, we're going to leave the profession. I said, why? Well, you know, there's a mistake, you know, where there's a problem where every year or 2 years we have to get recertified, we got to take tests again. Why can't that be like lawyers or doctors or other professions, engineers, where, you know, once you get licensed, you know, there's continuing education, of course, but at the same time, you can send in for recertification or licensing with a fee, and you're set to go. You know, this causes us a big headache, or we got to be taking exams. I said, you know, that makes sense. So I put a piece of legislation signed by the, you know, it was passed, of course, signed by the governor, and now it's the law of the land where for these emergency EMT services, they now are similar to the other professions. And sure enough, the timing of that, Hezzy, was just when the pandemic. Imagine during the pandemic if we were losing these, really, we call them heroes, but I can tell you how necessary having an adequate amount of EMT and emergency staff service people. And that was something that, you know, was a need. We addressed it. It was SAGE legislation, and sure enough, you know, the impact was immediate on society, on our nation and community, especially during the midst of the pandemic, where we needed that stability more than ever. You know,
That's what it's all about. Absolutely. Are you working on anything special? Do we keep it under wraps until it gets passed?
Well, you know, while we're doing a lot, and like I said to the listening audience, you know, a lot of people are reaching out. I was at a St. John's Hospital event last night, during the day and the night, and had a nice discussion with many, you know, CEOs and administrators and doctors and nurses and healthcare people. And I had a long talk with them and said, hey, I'm on the health committee of the New York State Assembly, and this is the time, if you have recommendations, if you feel there's a way to modify state policy on healthcare, and even sometimes the way insurance companies either provide coverage for people in need of certain conditions, or the reimbursement process, you know, whether insurance companies cover certain illnesses, or, you know, let's say pay hospitals or doctors for services that they provide, you know, should that be revised? Should that be changed? If so, how? And, you know, the message to these individuals, you know, that really represent healthcare in Yonkers and in our community, you know, how can we make the system better? You know, how can we fine-tune it? And that's what we need more, whether on the local, county, state, you know, on the federal level. For example, you know, I was at the Palmer House projects, you know, about 240 units right in Yonkers, and an issue they had with something as simple as, you know, being in a zip code, right? That's something that, you know, was on their agenda for years. Nobody addressed it. And we, you know, we spoke to them and said, you know what, if that's an issue, by the way, we provided all those families with COVID-19 tests, you know, because even though we feel safer, you want every family to have the COVID test available in their homes. If somebody needs them, they can always contact my assembly office. We're at 35 East Grassy Sprain Road in the Webster. Yeah. It used to be the Sterling Bank building. And we're on the fourth floor. You know, and the telephone here is 914-779-8805. You know, we're open 5 days a week. You know, we have staff here. They're very visible. They're very proactive. People that have any issues or concerns can reach out to the assembly office. We'll try to help them. If it's something that needs to be addressed on the local level, we'll hook them up to local government. If it's county, to county government. And very often, if it's federal, if it's Social Security related, or, you know, situation that deal with immigration, we have links already with the congressional level, where there's congressional staff every Wednesday afternoon at my office here in Yonkers. And that's part of a new initiative of bringing together local and county and state and federal government together, because at the end of the day, how do you make it more convenient for constituents? How do you make it easier for somebody that has a problem, you know, to be directed in the right direction or have their issues addressed? Too often you lack that. And, you know, and I'm trying hard, Hezzy, to, you know, teach other legislators. We have, for example, an online newsletter we send out every week. And, you know, 7,000 plus people in the district receive it. And it tells them about what's happening on the state level, on the local level, on the federal level, what programs and initiatives are available, what major programs are happening in the local community. And it's great. It's great for the residents to become aware and know what's going on and know where they can go to seek help. And that's what government is all about, if it works in the right way. And, you know, I'm looking forward to this November. I'm looking forward to a reelection. I'm very proud to say I'm the Democrat and now the Fair Play Party candidate, so that so that individuals can feel, hey, here's an assemblyman that, you know, understands Yonkers, that has lived Yonkers for over 60 years, knows it from the education, from the health, from the property owner, you know, and from the job development aspects. you know, these are things that I've had the pleasure of being involved for many, many years. And, you know, so it's a win-win. A win-win for Yonkers and
absolutely.
A win-win for the region. But appreciate it, Desi.
Well, that's what it's all about. I'm glad you're on the job. I don't think we would have accomplished as much without you there. I know. In fact, I know so.
Wow,
well,
my pleasure.
Anyway, I look forward every week to your spending the time with our listeners. It's always an honor. Thank you so much.
Desi,
the weekend.
Pleasure.
Good health.
Enjoy the weekend. Bye-bye.
You too, sir. Thank you very much. There we have it, folks. None other than Nader Sayers. He's the New York State Assembly member representing Assembly District 90, which is comprised of, in its entirety, of Yonkers. It doesn't cover all of Yonkers. I think about 85% of Yonkers is covered by him. And I believe that this is the only Assembly District in the entire state that is confined to one locality, even though there's another 15% that's outside of his realm. I don't even know why they don't bother to make it all one, but whatever. You know, there must be a rationale for it, and I am not familiar. And there's too many things that we were learning from Dr. Sayers to even interrupt his train of thought, because it just wouldn't be appropriate, as they would say. Well, let's cover a lot of stuff that's going on in the world state, and there is a lot of stuff that's going on. Well, the European Commission is recommending that Ukraine be granted European Union candidate status. It seems that the executive body of the European Union has recommended that Ukraine be granted European Union candidate status. Kyiv has sought candidate status since 2014. Well, the European Commission issued an opinion today recommending that Ukraine be granted European Union candidate status. Quote, Ukraine has clearly demonstrated its aspiration and determination to live up to European values and standards, so said the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. And in a later tweet, von der Leyen had said, quote, Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream. So the decision paves the way for European Union government leaders to sign off on the recommendations at a Brussels summit next Thursday and Friday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed the commission decision on Twitter, quote, I recommend, or rather he says, I commend the positive European Union Commission conclusion on Ukraine's candidate status. It's the first step on the European Union membership path that will certainly bring our victory closer. Zelensky went on to thank von der Leyen and the executive, quote, for a historic decision, end quote, and Kyiv has sought candidate status since 2014. Well, the Commission on Friday also proposed making Moldova a European Union candidate member. The European Union's executive said that this was premised on the understanding the country would carry out reforms. Von der Leyen said that Moldova, quote, is on a real pro-reform, anti-corruption, and European path, end quote. Adding, she said, it still has a long way to go, but we believe it has the potential to live up to the criteria, end quote. And the country shares a long stretch of border with Ukraine. Von der Leyen said in the case of Georgia, the country needed to, quote, design a clear path towards structural reform along with an assessment on how it would meet a number of conditions before granting candidate status. Well, Kremlin observing developments in a most careful way. It seems that the Kremlin has reacted to news of the European Commission recommending Ukraine for candidate European Union status. Quote, there are various transformations that we are observing in the most careful way, the Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov had told reporters during a telephone briefing on Friday. Peskov said that the matter, quote, requires our heightened attention, end quote, and that Moscow was monitoring what he described as the strengthening of the defense component of the European Union, end quote. And one reason Russia gives to justify its so-called special military operation in Ukraine is supposed is supposed Western encroachment on its doorstep, which Moscow considers a threat to its security. Okay, no one's come after the Russians, but what are you going to do? I guess they feel somehow, incompetent to protect their property. Anyway, Ukraine. It seems that Boris Johnson is made a second trip to Kiev. Well, the United Kingdom Prime Minister Boris Johnson has arrived in Kiev for a second surprise trip. Meanwhile, the European Commission recommended that Ukraine for European Union candidate status, and Macron offers to visit Moscow. The European Union Commission proposes that Ukraine become European Union membership candidate. Ukraine calls for a ceasefire to evacuate civilians from Severodonetsk chemical plant, and third American ex-Marine is captured by Russian forces. Well, Johnson arrived in Kyiv for a second visit since the invasion, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has made his way to Ukraine for a second time to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Mr. President Volodymyr, it's good to be in Kyiv again, he wrote on Twitter on arrival, sharing an image of the two of them together. Johnson's spokesman confirmed the visit on Friday after Johnson called off a campaign appointment in the northeast of England in Wakefield, ahead of a crucial by-election seen as an important litmus test for his premiership in the wake of the so-called Partygate, end quote, scandal, and him narrowly surviving a confidence vote within his Conservative Party last week. Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday said that the Russian economy had withstood Western sanctions imposed following what Russia calls the, quote, special military operation, end quote, in Ukraine. In an address at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, Putin called on Russian firms to boost domestic investment so the country could realize its gigantic potential, quote, end quote. And Putin accused the European Union of having lost its political sovereignty during his fiery address and criticized the bloc's economic policies, saying that the European Union was printing money, quote, end quote, in response to high inflation. Nothing will be as it used to be in global politics, Putin said during his address, which the Kremlin said was delayed because of a cyber attack. A spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said in a call to reporters that the cyber attack had begun on Thursday and had targeted the accreditation and admission system. Well, Ukraine scraps a visa-free travel for Russians. It seems that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky announced on Friday that Russians would be required to obtain visas from July 1. Well, Ukraine is introducing a visa system or visa regime for citizens of the Russian Federation, Zelensky said on his Telegram account. The move, according to Zelensky's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, was a result of Russia's invasion of the country on February 24 and was done to help bolster defensive efforts. Russia and Ukraine used to have a reciprocal visa-free travel agreement. However, since the invasion, the neighbors' borders have been officially closed. The Kremlin is observing developments in a most careful way, so they claim. The Kremlin has reacted to news, to the European Commission recommending Ukraine for candidate European Union status. Quote, there are various transformations that we are observing in the most careful way, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters during a telephone briefing on Friday. Peskov said that the matter, quote, requires our heightened attention, and that Moscow was monitoring what he described as the strengthening of the defense component of the European Union. Now, one reason Russia gives to justify its so-called special military operation in Ukraine is supposed Western encroachment on its doorstep, which Moscow considers a threat to its security. Well, Ukraine says that two are dead, 20 are injured in a Russian airstrike in Mykolaiv. A local governor said a Russian airstrike on the southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv killed two people and wounded 20 others, including a child. Governor Vitaly Kim said the attack also damaged four residential buildings and an infrastructure facility. Rescue work is ongoing, he said on Telegram. or European Union Commission recommends a candidate status for Ukraine. It seems that the European Commission recommended granting European Union candidate status to Ukraine and Moldova. Candidate status is not the same as European membership. It denotes the start of an often lengthy process toward joining the bloc. Quote, Ukraine has clearly shown commitment to live up to European values and standards, Commission President Ursula von der Leyen had said. The Commission gave its opinion on the matter to the European Union's 27 members after an agreement on the opinion in a meeting on Friday. Well, the bloc's government will have to decide how to proceed. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the issue, quote, requires our heightened attention because we are all aware of the intensification of discussions in Europe on the subject of strengthening the defense component of the European Union. So on Thursday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Romanian President Klaus Iohannis said in Kiev that they backed Ukraine's application for European Union candidate status. Ukraine and Moldova will likely face a long accession process. For Ukraine, the focus of the process will be promoting good governance, the rule of law, and measures to tackle corruption. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky submitted Ukraine's bid for European Union membership shortly after the war started in February. Ukraine is claiming to have hit a Russian boat in the Black Sea. Well, Ukraine's Navy said that they struck a Russian tugboat in the Black Sea with two Harpoon missiles. The vessel was believed to be carrying Russian troops. It is the first time Ukraine says it hit a Russian vessel with anti-ship rockets supplied by the West. Italy, France's operators say that Gazprom is cutting gas supplies. French network operator GRT Gaz said that France has not received any natural gas from Russia via pipeline since June 15, while Italy's Eni said it will receive only 50% of the gas requested Friday from the Russian energy giant. Italy has also accused the Russian state-backed Gazprom of peddling lies, quote-unquote, over a series of cuts. Gazprom said earlier this week that supply reductions to Europe via the undersea Nord Stream 1 pipeline were due to repair work. But officials in the European Union accused Russia of punishing Ukraine's allies over sanctions against Moscow. Well, the governor says that evacuations from Severodonetsk chemical plant are impossible, end quote. Shehi Hadai, the governor of the eastern Ukrainian region of Luhansk, said that there are 568 people sheltering in the Azot, A-Z-O-T, chemical plant in the city of Severodonetsk, where fighting has been raging. It is now impossible and physically dangerous to get out of the Azot plant due to constant shelling and fighting, Hadai said on Telegram, calling for a halt in fighting. Quote, exit from the plant is possible only with a complete ceasefire. Deutsche Welle correspondent in Ukraine, Roman Goncharenko, said that most of the trapped civilians are believed to be workers of the chemical plant and their families, and attempts to evacuate them yesterday failed, Goncharenko had added. Well, the Donbas humanitarian situation is extremely alarming. Well, the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA, raised concerns that the humanitarian conditions in the eastern Ukraine continue to deteriorate four months into the Russian invasion. Nearly 4 months since the start of the war, the humanitarian situation across Ukraine, particularly in the eastern Donbas, is extremely alarming and continues to deteriorate rapidly, the OCHA said in a statement. The situation in the key city of Severodonetsk, where heavy fighting has been taking place in recent weeks, is particularly worrying, the OCHA had added. And Ukrainian officials have said that thousands of civilians remain in the city, with hundreds sheltering in the local chemical plant. According to the OCHA, the United Nations and its partners have delivered aid to more than 8.8 million people across Ukraine since the Russian invasion started. Well, the UK Defense Intelligence advised that war speeding up Russia's trajectory towards authoritarianism. Well, in a regular intelligence report, the British Defense Ministry said that Russia was increasingly cracking down on opposition to the war. In Russia, the war has accelerated the state's long-term trajectory towards authoritarianism, the report added. Well, citing migration applications, the ministry said some 15,000 Russian millionaires were likely trying to leave the country. In addition, it added that the so-called Freedom for Russia Legion, which includes Russians fighting on Ukraine's side, has almost certainly deployed in combat alongside the Ukrainian military. It seems that the report noted that Russia's parliament was working to introduce a 20-year sentence for Russians who fight against Russia. Well, the United States Department confirms a third American captured. It seems the U.S. State Department confirmed the capture of a third American, a former Marine named Grady Kirkpatrick, CNN reported. His wife confirmed the report and said the last time Kirkpatrick was heard from was between April 23 and April 24. According to a photo caption on the U.S. Marine website, Kirkpatrick previously served as a captain in Korea. Macron says he's ready to travel to Moscow under preconditions. French President Emmanuel Macron said Paris was on Ukraine's side, but that it would move to avoid any escalation. While visiting Kyiv, Macron also discussed the possibility of going to Moscow to negotiate with Russia's Vladimir Putin. I think that a trip to Russia today requires preconditions. That means gestures from President Putin. I will not go there just like that, Macron told broadcaster KF1. So in turn, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky questioned if Putin was, quote, ready to hear anything, end quote, and if talks with any other world leader would change his mind. Macron last visited Putin in Moscow on February 8th, just weeks before Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine on February 24. The French president has since also called to the Russian leader on the phone. And standing side by side with Germany's Olaf Scholz, Macron also defended his earlier comment about how the West should, quote, not humiliate Russia, end quote. He said that France made this mistake with Germany at the end of World War I and lost the peace moving into World War II. What happened in Russia's invasion of Ukraine on Thursday? The leaders of Germany, France, Italy, and Romania voiced support for Ukraine's European Union membership bid during the highly anticipated visit to Kyiv. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Berlin strongly favored Ukraine and neighboring Moldova being granted EU candidate status. Standing side to side with Germany's Olaf Scholz, French President Emmanuel Macron defended his comment about how the West should not humiliate Russia, end quote. He said France made this mistake with Germany at the end of World War I and lost the peace moving into World War II. Well, by contrast, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Moscow hoped the German, French, and Italian leaders visiting Ukraine would, quote, push President Zelensky to take a realistic look at the state of affairs, end quote. Shehi Hadai, the governor of the eastern Ukrainian Luhansk region, said that around 10,000 civilians are still in the key city of Severodonetsk, where fighting has been raging amid a dire humanitarian condition. Well, former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, a letter to the Bundestag Budget Committee that challenges the decision to revoke his right to a parliamentary office. Schröder was Germany's Chancellor from 1998 to 2005, after which point he was involved with Russian energy firms Gazprom and Rosneft. Well, Britain's Foreign Ministry of Foreign Office announced sanctions on Patriarch Kirill, the leader of Russia's Orthodox Church, for his support and endorsement of President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Two U.S. citizens were reportedly captured by Russian forces in Ukraine. They were identified as Alexander Zlurka and Andy Hoon, U.S. Military veterans who had been living in the state of Alabama. So, my goodness, so that was the story there. Now, let me just quickly look at this. Bear with me a second here. Okay. No, don't want to look at that. Bear with me. This is a little bit... Okay, this is really very, very funny. There's a French comedy on Russian homophobia that was filmed in Ukraine. It seems the Revenge of the Shining Shrimps follows an all-clear water polo team that lands in homophobic Russia. But the scenes had to be shot in Ukraine before the war. Well, the fictional water LGBTQ polo team portrayed in the hit French comedy The Shining Shrimps was inspired by an actual group of people who practice a sport together. When Deutsche Welle met them at their Wednesday evening training in southern Paris, they were still warming up, all wearing bathing caps with bright orange plastic ear coverings. Quote, "You have to cover your opponent, and you have to do it with body contact," Coach Sebastian Besson told the athletes before they started playing. "Body contact is no problem," one of the players replied, and the others giggled. A whistle then kicked off the game. Half the team worked to get the ball into the opposing team's goal as many times as possible, while the other half sat on the substitute's bench on the sidelines. Well, the first film inspired by The Shining Shrimps came out in 2019. Now its sequel, The Shining Shrimps Strike Back, has been released in France and will soon be screened at international festivals. All while centering on the world of LGBTQ water polo, the new comedy also illustrates the culture clash that separates Russia from Europe and Ukraine. In the 2019 film, the Olympic champion swimmer is offered a chance to make up for a homophobic statement by coaching a gay water polo team. In the new comedy, the water polo team travels to Russia and encounters homophobia in that country. Director Cedric Ligayo, who played defense on the water polo team that Wednesday in Paris, had advised. On their way to the gay games in Tokyo, the players have to spend a night in Moscow because of a booking error. The police arrest some of them and take them to a gay conversion camp. Well, it is important to show that in some countries of the world, it's not easy to be gay, he said, including in Russia, where it is illegal to be a man kissing your boyfriend on the street because that's considered LGBTQI plus propaganda. So the law made it impossible for the crew to film in Russia. Well, Ukrainians want to be part of Europe. So in Ukraine, people speak Russian. Some of the architecture is reminiscent of Russia. So that is where filming took place from January to April of 2021. Ligayo still can't fathom that tanks are now rolling down the streets where he was filming and that people are dying in the war. "The whole situation just shows more clearly how different Ukraine and Russia are," he said. "Ukrainians want to be part of Europe. They are more like us and very different from Russians." Well, Coach Sebastian Besson, who was an extra in the film and part of the shooting in Ukraine, agrees, quote, "You could feel that Ukraine was in a positive momentum towards more personal freedoms, not only in terms of the LGBTQI plus rights," he advised, adding that at the moment, none of that matters. "It's terrible that there is a war going on in Ukraine. The actors we were shooting with a moment ago are now busy defending their country, fleeing or moving their family to safety," said Besson. Dmitry Solovyov is one of the film's actors. He plays the leader of a gang that goes around beating up gays. Months after the shoot, the 32-year-old Ukrainian is a member of a militia in the central province of Cherkasy. Until the Russian invasion began on February 24, we Ukrainians had many Russian friends and colleagues with whom we got along really well. He told Deutsche Welle via the news app Telegram, adding that this is no longer possible. Russia is now only an aggressor and an enemy. Actor Sasha Ivanov, who plays a Russian who admits himself to a gay conversion camp because he no longer wants to be gay, says the film is like a metaphor of the Russian state. The camp symbolizes Russia as evil, says the 20-year-old who fled to France just days before the Russian invasion began. The Russian state has been throwing people in prison for a long time just for being who they are, he says. Well, the shiny shrimps strike back, counters with that with a almost therapeutic message, and that is to love yourself and accept yourself as you are, adds Ivanov. Hopes for better times. Seems a war in this country deeply upsets Ivanov, who is confident that Russia will never be able to dominate Ukraine, end quote. After every war, every crisis comes a renaissance, a golden age of culture, he argues, recalling the wealth of cultural events, films, and concerts after the 2014 Maidan Revolution. After this war, it will be the same. The film gives hope to Solovyov, too. This is such a wonderful film about life and free love. I hope we will all work together on the third part soon. So very, very interesting. Now, let's just look at some other things that are around here that you might find interesting. One second. One moment here. I think you'll find this interesting. Severe droughts have revealed the sunken relics or relics of the past. So as the climate crisis intensifies droughts from Iraq to Spain to the United States, remnants of past towns and societies have reemerged from receding waters. So droughts can be a normal part of the climate, but as temperatures rise in the wake of global heating, these dry spells are becoming more severe and longer in many regions. The trend can disrupt entire food systems, pushing millions into starvation and dehydration. In an unusual twist, current high-emitting lifestyle has also helped reveal how we used to live before the climate crisis became quite so urgent, and that's because droughts have uncovered remnants of past communities, some of them thousands of years old. Iraq. Well, in 2018, drought in the Kurdish region of Iraq provided a rare glimpse into a little-known society, the Mitanni Empire. German and Kurdish archaeologists discovered a 3,400-year-old palace from the Bronze Age on the shores of the Tigris River. After water levels in the Mosul Dam Reservoir went down enough to reveal the ruins. The ancient palace belonged to a kingdom that once dominated large parts of northern Mesopotamia and Syria. The Mitanni Empire is one of the least researched empires of the ancient Near East. Archaeologist Ivana Pulis of Germany's University Tübingen said at the time, even the capital of the Mitanni Empire has not been identified beyond doubt. The team partially found preserved wall paintings and 10 cuneiform clay tablets in the rooms it excavated. By studying the tablets, archaeologists hope to learn more about the empire, a ghost village in Spain. It seems more recently a Spanish village that was flooded to create a reservoir reemerged when a drought hit this February, and visitors flocked to Acevedo on the Spanish-Portuguese border to see the eerie ruins and 1992 mementos, beer bottles, and rusty cards included. Well, Maria del Carmen Yanez, mayor of the larger Lobillos Council that Acevedo belongs to, told Reuters it had rained very little in recent months. But she also blamed the situation on the Portuguese power utility EDP and its, quote, quite aggressive exploitation, end quote, of the reservoir where the company runs a hydroelectric plant. EDP acknowledged the reservoir levels were low because of the drought, but told Reuters it ran its water resources efficiently and above the minimum requirements. Well, there's a gold rush relics in California. So in the mid-1800s, a gold rush in California attracted hundreds of thousands of miners during their luck. And last year, it was tourists traveling to the area after a drought significantly emptied the lake in which gold rush towns were submerged, in a stark reminder of the United States' ongoing water crisis. With historically low water levels that have been worsened by the impacts of climate change, artifacts and ruins once belonged to past communities and cultures of the area are now appearing along the waterbed. A Facebook post by the Folsom Lake State Recreation Area had read, well, visitors could look at the ruins of places like Mormon Island, which attracted thousands of Mormon fortune seekers in its heyday. The town had several shops, four hotels, and an express office before it burned down in 1856. Tourists risk a fine if they tamper with the remains at the site. Well, the Edersee in the western German state of Hesse is the second largest reservoir in the country. But as extreme heat and low rainfall have intensified droughts across Germany, when the Edersee's water levels drop, they reveal what is known as the region's Atlantis. Here lie ruins, including those of a bridge, three villages, and gravestones of one-time locals. The area was originally flooded to make way for the reservoir. The project was built more than 100 years ago to provide water for the Weser, or Weser, W-E-S-E-R River, and Mittelland Canal, or Middleland Canal, ensuring ships could travel on them during drier summer months. And German Emperor Wilhelm II even paid a personal visit to the construction site in 1911. Now the sunken villages have turned into a tourist attraction when Edersee's levels drop low enough to during hot periods. So those are some of the issues that have come about, which is really very fascinating. It's amazing how far we've gone with the climate. One second here. This you'll find interesting. Gazprom, the Russian supplier, has reduced gas supplies to Italy, and France has been cut off. An Italian energy firm says the Russian company is slashing its deliveries by 50%. And France's gas operator says it has not received any natural gas from Russia via its pipeline from Germany for more than a month. Italy's energy firm Eni said on Friday that Russian energy giant Gazprom was reducing its gas supplies to Italy by 50%. In recent weeks, Moscow has reduced or cut off gas deliveries to several European Union countries, which have imposed sanctions on Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. French network operator GRT Gaz also said on Friday that France had not received any Russian gas via Germany since May 15, citing the effects of reduced Russian supply. And Russian officials blamed maintenance issues at the Nord Stream 1 pipeline from Russia to Germany. Italy gets around 40% of its imported gas from Russia, though it is trying to reduce its reliance. And France gets around 17% of its gas from Russia through network connections with Germany. Italy is accusing Gazprom of lies. Well, previously this week, Gazprom's gas deliveries to Italy had already been reduced 15% on Wednesday and 35% on Thursday. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, who was on a visit to Kiev with German and French leaders, rejected Gazprom's technical reasons as an excuse. Both Germany and us and others believe these are lies. In reality, they are making a political use of gas like they are using grain for political use, Draghi said at a news conference in Kyiv with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and French President Emmanuel Macron. So less Russian gas delivery to Europe. Seems like Gazprom cut deliveries to Germany by more than 60% this week. The Russian state-controlled company said that supply reductions via the undersea Nord Stream 1 pipeline were due to delays in repair work by the German company Siemens. But Germany claimed that Gazprom's move was politically motivated. Nord Stream 1 is the main pipeline of Russian gas to Europe after gas flows through Ukraine were reduced amid the war. On Thursday, European Union Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni warned that the bloc's economy could enter a recession if Russian gas supplies stop, but stressed that this was not the case so far. So, amazing stuff that's going on, huh? One second. One second here. Just see if I can catch up. This is interesting because the Europeans are usually ahead of us. A German health minister hints at stricter winter COVID rules. So German health minister Karl Lauterbach has recommended the voluntary wearing of masks in indoor publics amid a summer wave of infections. He also indicated that stricter rules are likely on their way. Germany's health ministry on Friday recommends that Germans should still wear masks in indoor public places, although this would be on a voluntary basis for the time being. However, Health Minister Karl Lauterbach said that the country should prepare again for stricter coronavirus rules as the winter months approach. Lauterbach said that the country would need to adopt new rules for the winter period, liking it to adopting winter tires instead of summer ones. This reference is to a law that requires motorists to drive with special winter tires over the period from October to Easter. And the move came in response to a report by the website of Germany's Welt am Sonntag, that means the Welt, the World on Sunday newspaper. That's what Welt am Sonntag means. It said that the government was considering a rule that would make indoor mask wearing in public places mandatory over the same period. And while he conceded that current data on infections did not justify making mask use a legal requirement at present, Lauterbach himself, a trained epidemiologist, said it was sensible to continue to wear masks indoors in the meantime. This must be a norm, he said. Before coronavirus regulations were relaxed in Germany earlier this year, it was mandatory to wear masks in indoor public places, such as supermarkets. And people using public transport are still required by law to cover their mouth and nose. And Germany is currently experiencing an expected summer wave of coronavirus infections. Lauterbach said that although there is no need to panic, he pointed out that the virus still posed a deadly risk for some, also carrying with it the danger of COVID long COVID for the wider population. We have the situation well under control right now, but not solved. We don't need to panic about a summer surge. The minister said that experts are less concerned than they might be because the dominant Omicron variant usually runs a less harmful course than, for example, the Delta strain. And many in Germany have also been vaccinated or have recovered from the BA2 virus type, meaning they are relatively well protected. Well, despite this, Germany has recently been reporting between 50 and 130 coronavirus-related deaths per day. Meanwhile, some 80% of people over 60 deemed still vulnerable have not received a second booster shot. Lauterbach urged them, along with people who have a high level of contact with other individuals, to do so right away. Well, the minister highlighted seven measures the government would take to prepare for the upcoming winter months, and these were, quote, preparation for an immunization campaign with three different vaccines available, revising the provision for free coronavirus tests for citizens and residents, improving the supply and targeting of treatments shown to be effective against COVID infections, improving hygiene arrangements in places where vulnerable people live, such as nursing homes, provision of more up-to-date electronic data on free intensive care beds, and revising hygiene and contact measures in schools and nurseries to reduce the need for closures. A revision of Germany's Infection Protection Act well in advance of its expiry on September 23rd. the German municipal leaders have urged the government to contain the summer wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Markus Löwe, head of the Association of German Cities, told the newspapers of the Funke media group that a new Infection Protection Act was needed before Parliament broke up for the summer. He said it was becoming clear that current legal measures are not sufficient. The coronavirus pandemic must not keep taking us for surprise, he said. In the latest figures, Germany's Robert Koch Institute for Disease Control on Friday said that the incidence rate for the past 7 days was at 427.8. This was lower than for the previous day of 480, but significantly higher than last Friday's seven-day figure of 318.7. That's the story. So we'll have to see where all of this goes and how it's going to be translated one way or the other and or defined. 1 second. All right, where are we? Oh, yes, here it is. The British government has upheld Julian Assange's extradition request. The British Home Secretary has signed an order authorizing the extradition of Julian Assange. The WikiLeaks founder has been involved in a legal battle for more than a decade over the release of classified U.S. data. Well, British Home Secretary Priti Patel signed an order on Friday authorizing the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. He is wanted in the United States on 18 criminal charges, including breaking a spying law relating to the release by WikiLeaks of vast troves of confidential U.S. military records and diplomatic cables that Washington said had put lives in danger. On June 17, following a consideration by both the Magistrates Court and High Court, the extradition of Julian Assange to the United States was ordered. Mr. Assange retains the normal 14-day right to appeal, the Home Office said in a statement. WikiLeaks, the organization founded by Assange, said in a tweet that the approval of the extradition was, quote, a dark day for press freedom and for British democracy, end quote. WikiLeaks insisted that Assange did nothing wrong and was being punished for doing his job and indicated that the decision would be appealed. The organization slammed the British Home Secretary, saying it was in Priti Patel's power to do the right thing. Instead, she will forever be remembered as an accomplice to the United States in an agenda to turn investigative journalism into a criminal enterprise. Assange's wife, Stella, a lawyer, who married a husband in a prison ceremony in March, confirmed that he would appeal the decision. We're going to fight this. We're going to use every appeal avenue, she said. Stella Assange called the decision a travesty, quote unquote, and said she would, quote, spend every waking hour fighting for Julian until he is free, until justice is served. And legal experts say the appeals process could involve months of court hearings. The U.S. case against Assange. Well, the U.S. has asked British authorities to extradite Assange so he can stand trial over thousands of diplomatic or secret diplomatic cables and military files that WikiLeaks published online in 2010. He faces 17 charges of espionage and one charge of computer misuse. American prosecutors allege that Assange unlawfully helped U.S. military intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning steal the campaign documents that were later published, putting lives at risk. Assange denies any wrongdoing. His supporters allege the case against him is politically motivated. They argue he was acting as a journalist and as such is entitled to freedom of speech for publishing documents that exposed U.S. military misconduct during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, had ruled that Assange should not be deported, saying his mental health meant he would be at risk of suicide if convicted and held in a maximum security prison. But this was overturned on an appeal after the U.S. gave a package of assurances, including a pledge he could be transferred to Australia to serve any sentence. Assange was also at the center of a separate legal saga that unfolded in 2010 when Sweden sought his extradition from Britain over allegations of sex crimes. His supporters accused Stockholm of being part of a campaign by the U.S. Pentagon to smear the WikiLeaks founder, which the Swedish government denied. When Assange lost that case in 2012, he fled to the European to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he spent 7 years. When he was finally dragged out of the diplomatic building in April of 2019, he was jailed for breaching British bail conditions, even though the Swedish case had been dropped. Assange has been fighting extradition to the United States since June of that year and remains in London's high-security Belmarsh prison. Boy, my God, it's amazing how long this case has been going on. Now, this is very, very interesting. The war in Ukraine is boosting U.S.-German relations. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has unified the Western alliance with relations between the United States and Germany at the forefront, and their shared geopolitical vision is counting on big commitments both sides have made. U.S.-German relations are experiencing a renaissance after a stressful two decades which saw tensions between the two sides rise due to the Iraq War, spying revelations, and former President Donald Trump's frequent taunts. That is no small feat. Russia's war in Ukraine has given the relationship renewed purpose, but observers of the alliance say that the rekindling was already underway before the invasion. Well, the Cold War accompanied President Joe Biden's political ascent and his foreign policy team and actions reflect Europe as his comfort zone. The war in Ukraine has had a galvanizing effect on the entire Atlantic alliance, and Germany is no exception. Daniel Benjamin, a former State Department official and now president of the American Academy in Berlin, advised. The new administration came in with a particular focus on Germany and a desire to repair the harm that had been done to the relationship. Common cause to oppose Russia has hastened the repair work. U.S. officials were delighted when Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced that his government was effectively killing the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which President Joe Biden had called a bad deal for Europe. Instead, Germany says it is scrambling to expand liquid natural gas terminals that would increase the country's ability to import the fuel from the United States. Well, the U.S. has thrown more at the fight against Russia in both absolute terms and relative to gross domestic product, and Germany has struggled to shake its reputation of not pulling its weight within the broader NATO alliance. And through June 7, Germany has delivered to Ukraine 35% of the military aid it has committed, according to the Kiel Institute for the World Economy. So the U.S. has made good on nearly half, while other countries such as Poland and Baltic countries are at or near 100%. So in the Trump era, the lackluster figures may have prompted a public dressing down, and the Biden administration has taken a different tack. We applaud Germany's contributions and strongly encourage it and other countries to provide the necessary military equipment for Ukraine to defend itself against Russia. Joe Giordano Schultz, the spokesman person for the U.S. Embassy in Germany, advised. Cooperation between the United States and allies like Germany, which he called unprecedented, quote unquote, goes beyond Ukraine and is designed to reinforce each other and intensify over time. Well, a cornerstone of the former term outlook is Scholz's successful push to take out an additional $110 billion in debt to invest in the German military. While that is a consequence of the war, it does little to directly impact the course of it. Rather, German security analysts see it as a better late-than-never investment, making up for years of neglect. It won't necessarily put German tanks on Ukrainian battlefields, but it could help Germany convince its allies and adversaries that it is serious about defending every centimeter of NATO territory, as Scholz has often said. And though Scholz's three-party ruling coalition got the conservative opposition to agree to the sum, it remains unclear how exactly the German Defense Ministry, which has struggled with procurement, will spend it. At the least, some of the money will flow to American arms and manufacturers who produce the advanced weaponry that Germany has expressed an interest in purchasing. The F-35 stealth fighter is high on that list, although the U.S. Defense Department has not approved it for a full-scale production for its own forces, and the project is over budget and behind schedule, according to an April report from the U.S. Department Accountability Office. Placing an order is a signal from Germany that it remains committed to NATO's nuclear sharing arrangement. The F-35 would maintain its ability to carry American nuclear weapons after the aging Tornado fighter gets retired, and doing so is a top U.S. expectation of European allies, but a touchy domestic issue in Germany. And both Scholz's Social Democrats and his Green partners in government see themselves as disarmament parties. The Greens have been especially critical of nuclear sharing, but Scholz's self-styled Zeitenwende, a historic turning point as a result of the war, has meant policy positions once considered sacrosanct up for reconsideration. So when added to regular spending, supplemental funding will give Germany, in absolute numbers, the largest defense budget in Europe. Political analysts believe that the debt-financed spending spree as a symbol of German credibility with potentially significant strategic consequences for U.S. interests. Unlike its European allies, the U.S. views itself as a natural Pacific power. In direct competition with European allies, the U.S. views itself as a natural Pacific power, and for years the U.S. foreign policy has struggled to pay more attention to East Asia without compromising its security commitments across the Atlantic. America cannot pivot to Asia without a huge risk to Europe, without a successful Zeitenwende. The U.S. can lead, but Europe would be very exposed. Michal Baranowski, a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, advised Deutsche Welle. Well, his nightmare scenario is one in which the war in Ukraine does not break Russia. The U.S. focus drifts away from Europe, and Germany does not pick up the security slack. That basically gives Russia, again, a chance to rebuild its powers and forces, but this time push beyond Ukraine, Baranowski had said. Well, on the American side, the danger to the relationship is domestic. Biden is already looking weak heading into November's midterm election, when the party that controls the White House typically loses seats in Congress. It is unclear if, however, if whoever takes his place after one or two terms will share his administration's embrace of longstanding partnerships such as with Germany. About 6 in 10 Americans and Germans agree that the Biden and Scholz administrations have helped strengthen relations, according to a new survey for the nonprofit Atlantique Brücke. Even larger majority, 71% of Americans and 81% of Germans, say that the relationship should transcend the government in power. And the war in Ukraine has increased the level of trust each has in the other, and the online survey found, though both remain skeptical of the other's institutions, to, quote, do what is right. So the optimist in me says that will be a durable trend beyond the Biden administration. Benjamin, the American Academy president, said, if both sides take a view of the global situation. So I guess that's a big issue. I think that will be it for us today. Just want to see if there's anything we've missed here. One second. All right, let me just see what else we have. All right, let me just quickly see Is there anything else that I haven't picked up in the news? Oh, 1 minute. Okay. One second. I think we're actually okay. So we're going to wish you a good weekend and hope to speak to you on Monday. And just take care of each other as well as yourselves. And stay healthy, whatever you do. Take care and goodbye. Thank you.